Well, welcome everyone to our Weber Training Teleclass, Costs of Healthcare Associated Infection. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my friend and colleague, Dr. Syed Zatar, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us today in this teleclass. A very special welcome to everyone who is joining this as their first teleclass. This is going to be a good one. Now, I have known Professor Barry Cookson for some time. I know him to be an experienced lecturer, certainly a very well-traveled one. He's regularly summoned to places all over the globe to give his educated opinion and to speak to audiences large and small. He is very popular with his students at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and at the University of London. And on a more personal level, I'll tell you that he makes an excellent and very interesting dinner companion. And to my knowledge, he is the only member of our teleclass faculty to be listed in the Guinness Book of World Records. And I'll leave it to Barry to tell you what that was all about, if there's time. It's a real honor to have him give this teleclass lecture, and it's about time that I stopped rambling on and let him get to it. So to give the teleclass, Costs of Healthcare-Associated Infection from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and the University of London, it is my pleasure to introduce the one and absolutely the only Professor Barry Cookson. Barry.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. Quite an introduction. Just so everyone knows, this is my first attempt at this, and in a big yellow post-it on the side of my computer, I've got this thing which says next slide, which is to remind me that I must say this in between each slide. So I'll try and remember that. So here goes. You've got the first slide with just my name on it. I'm at the Health Protection Agency, amongst other things. Next slide. So why are we actually giving this lecture today? Well, econometrics has got a very high priority now in healthcare. And you can see how we practice neurosurgery in this country on the cartoon on the right. Still not quite up to the standards of some other countries. There is an interesting rubric here. Certainly in the UK and I know the US, the patient is at long last, the focus of healthcare delivery. And there's a tremendous emphasis on continuous quality improvement with both patient safety and improving the quality of patient care. And indeed, as many of you will know, there's a WHO Global Patient Safety Alliance launched last year, and it's interesting that their first major project is in hand hygiene. But looking at these priorities, the healthcare delivery system has also got to look at the cost effectiveness of what they're doing because, next slide, treatment is becoming increasingly complex and very costly. Next slide. And in addition to that, patients are expecting much, much better value for money and more choice in treatment. And this particular slide refers to the UK situation where patients are now traveling quite widely, for instance, to France and to the Netherlands for treatment. And there was actually a case in court which said they should be able to do this to improve the quality of their care. Now, this obviously is a very interesting area in terms of cost effectiveness, and it's also a very interesting area in terms of the spread of antimicrobial resistance, both outside and back to the UK. Next slide. Now, why has hospital infection got this high profile? Well, it's against this background of this increasing pressure to improve cost effectiveness of healthcare delivery. And policymakers and indeed politicians are now long last getting the message that infection control is a very useful area to look at with, for instance, risk assessment, total quality improvement, to gauge the whole quality of the whole organization. This is because really all healthcare workers should be involved in infection control. And we've certainly won this battle in the UK with, for instance, the insurance agencies and the Healthcare Commission. And they've actually joined forces and are really focusing here. And we've got round the problem shown in this French cartoon on the right that we've had many, many different organizations investigating us. And we're forgetting that actually patient care is one of the major deliverables. The other major point about the high profile is that they're also getting the message that hospital-acquired infection is a significant burden, and it has got to be cost-effective to invest in control and prevention. Next slide. So in this lecture, I'll be, first of all, covering various aspects of terminology and giving one or two examples. And I must emphasize that I am not an economist. I'm just a humble medical microbiologist who's been working with a few of them and knows perhaps a little bit more about it than I used to 2 or 3 years ago. And I'm going to be illustrating some of the points I'm making with 3 papers that we've published, and all the references are actually at the end as well for you. Next slide. Terminology. The first term is direct costs. Now, these include the costs that are identified to provide patient care, and they comprise 2 areas. Fixed costs, unrelated to patient volume, for example, your core staff, and variable costs, which are related to volume, so for instance, drugs, and I would also include agency staff. Next slide. Now, those of you who have read papers, perhaps like me, are very confused about the terminology, and a very good example of this is indirect costs. Now, I've included in these opportunity costs and intangible costs, but opinions do differ, and actually another slide later on itself is slightly at variance as well, but never mind. Opportunity costs, I consider this to be the value of the next best alternative use of the resources. So, for example, a lost bed day. Intangible costs, they're the costs of pain on the quality of life, and we'll discuss that later. But then there are also some other interesting areas which we never discuss, and these include joint production. I should think Paul uses these quite heavily, the teaching spin-offs from healthcare delivery itself, for instance, case presentations on infections. Next slide. Cost analysis is very simple, how much you're spending on a program. Far more important and interesting is economic evaluation, where you look at cost analysis and the outcomes. Next slide. There are various ways to evaluate the costs. First of all, there's cost effectiveness. So, for instance, you compare the costs of interventions per case prevented or life saved. And here it's very important that you look at all the cost vectors, all the full costs involved. And we're well used to this with many, many years with the pharmaceutical industry, where they're comparing drug A against drug B. And a good example of this is comparing oral with parenteral drugs. And with the parenteral drugs, you've got to look at the cost of the syringes and the swabs, monitoring the disposal of vials, avoiding needle stick injuries, and so on. And as you well know, this wasn't done very well maybe 20 years ago, but has now been done a lot better. Then there's the very difficult area of cost utility analysis, where you're comparing outcomes in terms of subjective values of people or society. The QALY is the simplest and most commonly used one. The World Bank has just used the dilly-dally. An example of it is down below, 15 years functioning at a third of full health is 5-year full health functioning. Next slide. The cost-benefit area is very complex, and it's the least used, and some people have actually compared this to the randomized controlled trial. 2 areas are addressed here, the net present value, value of benefits minus costs, and probably more known to people, the cost-benefit ratio, where all the costs and benefits are assessed, the indirect costs, for instance, disability, the intangible costs, for instance, pain. Next slide. The subjectivity is a very, very interesting area here, and as you can see, the food in England has not improved. Next slide. The more modern approaches here, which certainly one or two people in this country have been using, is to get all the players together in what's called scenario setting. And here they actually discuss value, and you eventually have, if you like, a multidisciplinary output, a lot of ownership there. But there are a couple of other examples there, with rheumatoid arthritis, how much they'd pay of their income not to have it, and that I got that last thing there, I've actually got from an American infection control magazine, where an infection control doctor said people should pay $5 a day to support infection control. No justification for it, but that was his view. Next slide. Willingness to pay is very important in this particular area, and there are lots of techniques that have been used, but they are influenced directly by the background, the context, and how much individuals are used to directly paying for their health services. So compare England with America, for example. I've just come back from Bulgaria. That would be, again, different from England. Studies show that individuals significantly inflate their willingness to pay, rather like they underestimate how many cigarettes they smoke a day. I was always told as a medical student to double it. And it's usually related to their income, in other words, their ability to pay. So resources are directed towards programs which have a greater impact on the more affluent. So it's important when looking at such studies to consider that that rubric. Next slide, other terminology. Very quickly, marginal analysis. This is a very interesting area where you're looking at the margins between increased expenditure, production, and outcomes. And a good example of that would be, for instance, in orthopedic infections, where you're adding interventions with more specialized ventilation and looking at the costs of the infections prevented. In those studies, it's important to consider the longer-term implications of having infection, which can be over many, many years, as you probably know. Incremental analysis is where the cost per case between two interventions is compared. And then down the bottom, you have production expenses. These are the more peripheral things which people often forget, the expenditure involved, for instance, with needle stick avoidance measures. Next slide. Cost identifications, what does it cost to produce an intervention or alternative? Here you've got to identify the cost of all the items and activities and put a cost to them. The cheapest way of doing this is retrospectively, but it's very limited in what you can identify. You can't get all the cost vectors that you really need. To do that, you really need to have a prospective study, and how good that study is depends on just how much effort you put into it and how much cost you put into it. And I'll give you a good example of that with the Plowman study later on. We use an analytical approach there, identifying all the process steps and resources used. And with these analyses, it's very important to mention sensitivity analysis. Now, this is not the usual term that microbiologists are used to, with the sensitivity of a test being a false negative. This is really more like the confidence interval around the calculations. This is used, for instance, in modeling. The most common modeling used to be statistical or deterministic, and now we tend to also use modeling by chance or stochastic, and there are special programs that are used for that. And again, sensitive analysis is used with those, as you'll see later, in the deterministic modeling we've used in a couple of the studies. Next slide. Concurrent ways of looking at additional costs. Well, Haley here has trained people in that particular study to estimate the additional resources used, and that's quite an interesting study. And some have simply estimated the costs attributable to the underlying condition due to hospital infection or to both, and their references there. Next slide. Comparative costings, there are a couple of studies here where you're comparing the level of resource for the infected and matched non-infected patients, and there was a very interesting article in ICHI just a couple of months ago with the problems of case-controlled studies, which is well worth reading. Large samples are needed, and the inability to match may well skew the results. We used regression techniques in our study, and we also used another statistical approach to try and correct for the endogenicity of infection. And there's a paper coming out shortly, I hope, from Nick Graves on this, where they've used another approach, and that's explained in the next slide. Endogenicity is the collinearity between acquiring an infection and the length of stay. So hospital-acquired infection prolongs length of stay, and prolonged length of stay increases the risk of a hospital-acquired infection. So looking at the costs of length of stay, you may over-attribute this to the hospital-acquired infection. There may be factors underlying cases which you really aren't sure about, which are contributing to that length of stay. It's not just the hospital-acquired infection. Now, the Graves study, which you can see if you go into Google and put Weinhold, Weinhold, and the London School of Economics, LSE, if you do that, you'll go into the website, and there is actually a draft of the paper there. And there are, I think, one or two areas that need to be corrected, and I'm sure the actual final paper will have those corrected. But it was an interesting approach there. They looked at the factors that increase the risks of HAIs, but not the length of stay. And their two hypotheses here were nasogastric tube and oxygen therapy. And then they use a strategy to review the costs of HAIs. And I think the actual conclusions are that you have overestimated the cost of HAI. Next slide. Now, this is the paper which you have the reference to. And I intend to go over this fairly quickly because it is written up, and I've put some resource slides in as well. Now, the background to this was that previous studies have shown that there is a substantial economic burden to the health sector, and they've also shown that it varies with the site of infection. But they provided actually very limited data on the distribution of inpatient costs, and in general, such studies have limited themselves to the hospital sector alone. Next slide. These are resource slides, a couple of studies here with the references at the end showing the relatively lower cost for urinary tract infections in these two specialties. Next slide. And this is four studies here of the costs of surgical site infections in various countries. Slightly higher, as you can see. And then chest infections, and these are in very seriously ill patients in intensive care unit, but also down below all admissions, with very high costs indeed. Next slide. And these are three references to show that certainly people have looked in the community a bit with orthopedic infections, that was the US, I think, and then inpatient and post-discharge hospital costs with surgical infections. And there they looked at the compensation factors in Finland. And Fabre also did a nice study looking at the implications of surgical infections delaying the return to work. Next slide. So the aims of this particular study were to determine the overall burden of hospital infection, both to the secondary and primary healthcare sectors and the community care services, the impact on the health status of patients, the costs to patients, their carers, and the economy, and to establish the relative cost of different types of hospital-acquired infection. Next slide. And to determine the type of patients who incur the highest costs for specific infections. Next slide. The study was over a one-year period in adult non-day case patients admitted to selected specialties of the National Health Service District General Hospital. And this did not include, very importantly, the intensive care unit. Cost profiles were developed for each patient, whether or not they had a hospital-acquired infection, and then we used statistical techniques to estimate how much of the observed variation in costs incurred by the infected compared to uninfected patients, and how much could be explained by the presence of an HAI from these analyses. Now, the paper, and there are four books on this, there are two PhDs that came out of this, a huge amount of data. We had about six or seven nurses employed on this, and the whole thing cost, I think, £1.25 million. Huge amounts of data, semi-structured interviews, and Nick's PhD actually looked at other ways of costing healthcare, much more specialized PhD, if you like. Ros Plowman's actually looked at the hospital-acquired infection. Next slide. And there was a lot of work done, again, with a couple of staff devoted to this, with post-discharge questionnaires. And I'm sure the audience will know the complexities of doing this. And these are the factors that we collected. So we've already said the statistical techniques that we used, and we controlled with these methods for age, sex and diagnosis, comorbidities, the admission type and specialty, and the time of return of the questionnaire. Next slide. 4,000 patients, and almost all completed the inpatient data sets, which is a pretty good record, I think. Over 1,400 were selected for follow-up after discharge, of which nearly 15% had had a hospital infection identified whilst in hospital. 71% of the patients selected for follow-up returned the questionnaire. So again, good returns. And we did look at the non-returns and their representativity and so on, and it was good. Next slide. No surprises here. The incidence as much as in other countries, 7.8% with one or more hospital-acquired infection. And again, not bad, 19% had symptoms or signs, interpretation of association or diagnosis was difficult after discharge, and 30% of inpatients with hospital-acquired infection met the study criteria for one or more infections present after discharge. Now, the literature's got a huge range here. Perhaps we can discuss that later on, but the methods, case mix, length of stay, and so on have varied in these studies, and I would say that's a sort of pretty average results, probably pretty okay. Next slide. Again, no surprises here. The urinary tract infections, the commonest, followed by multiple, which always included bloodstream infections and chest infections, and others were less. Next slide. The costs to the hospital sector with patients with one or more HAIs during their hospital stay, they had 2.5 times longer length of stay than the uninfected controls. That's about an extra 11 days per case. And they incurred nearly 3 times more costs, and that's nearly £3,000 per case. I can't remember the exchange rate. It's probably about $2 per pound, I think, at present. Next slide. Now, this is an interesting slide. This is showing you that, 75% of the costs are related to just two areas, nursing care and what some people call the hotel charges, the hospital overheads, capital charges, and management. Now, be careful in extrapolating from this to other healthcare systems. For instance, in the developing world, nursing care comes cheap and disposables, etc., become more expensive. But it is showing you the amount of work we did here for relatively little return, but someone had to do it, I guess. Next slide. But by that I mean the relatively little return of the other factors. This is in the publication as well, and it shows you the different sites of infection, the ratio of the costs, and then the model estimates on the right-hand side. And you can see it goes from urinary tract infections right up to the most expensive, the multiple infections, and the bloodstream infections, although low in number, are expensive. And then you've got the average, as I've already stated, down the bottom. Next slide. Importantly for this study, the numbers of infections are very important to look at. And if you look at this, you'll see that the burden for urinary tract infections is quite considerable. So Lauren Chu out there will be quite pleased about that in terms of her interventions that she's using. Next slide. Costs incurred post-discharge. Those people having a hospital-acquired infection identified in hospital and or having one identified after discharge had more contact with their GPs, district nurses, or in outpatients with the doctor nurses at the hospital. The level of increase varied depending on whether the patient had a hospital-acquired infection identified in the hospital and or an infection identified post-discharge. Next slide. The full details are in the paper. And on average, patients who had a hospital-acquired infection identified in hospital or after discharge incurred more personal expenses, took longer to resume normal daily activities or return to work, received more carers from their informal carers, that's their friends or relatives, and they had a lower health status 4 weeks after discharge from hospital. And there have been some other studies recently showing that it can be considerably longer than that. Next slide. Now, we were very lucky that, this is pure by chance, when we got the data about a year after the study was completed for the District General Hospital figures for admissions and so on around the country, our hospital was slap bang in the middle of the distribution. So it meant that we were able to fairly easily generalize to the rest of the country. And our cases only represented 70% of all adult non-day case admissions. So it's very conservative. It doesn't include renal units, liver units, intensive care units, pediatric units. And just looking at those cases, we've got nearly £1 billion per year and over three and a half million bed days being lost. Next slide. And this is the breakdown of those costs, the inpatients, GPs, outpatients, and district nursing. Next slide. And this is the distribution by site of infection, helping you with prioritization. Next slide. Oh, it's gone down into a... Oh, dear. Sorry, my... I'm going to have to switch out of... Sorry, I'm having a problem with Bill Gates here. It's collapsing on me. I think there's a... Okay. The next slide at last. Implications of policy and practice. We've shown that there was a substantial burden of hospital-acquired infection, and the effect in terms of health sector resources. We need to look at the benefits of prevention. And the way we did that was we took a couple of estimates. Now, there's the Senec estimate saying that about a third of infections are preventable. And we chose to take a much lower factor. The views of infection control teams in the UK in 2000, who estimated that about a 15% were preventable. So just using 15%, we suggested that £150 million were potentially saved, over 500,000 bed days, and over 70,000 consultant episodes. Now, we also had looked at the impact on health status, and again, politicians have got a little bit of a problem in this area. I think it's all a bit sort of subjective. We also did not factor in the cost of deaths, because that's a hugely complex area, but certainly death was much higher in those patients with a hospital-acquired infection. Now, we've used this very powerfully indeed in the UK. This is probably one of the most frequently quoted studies in the press. It's been used in the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and the National Audit Office have also used it. And it's being used very powerfully to raise the profile of hospital-acquired infection. Next slide. We're now changing the subject, and we're going to MRSA. Next slide. And this is a very important area. You've got to balance the benefit of interventions, reductions of direct, indirect, and intangible costs of hospital-acquired infection due to MRSA. You've got the possibilities of reducing other hospital-acquired infections if you reduce MRSA. The literature differs depending on the papers you quote there. The costs of all the interventions, screening tests, isolation strategies, disposables, extra staffing. Quite a complex rubric, this, and in fact not an awful lot has been done to unravel these and to actually look at the cost effectiveness of alternative strategies. So what I'm going to describe to you are two attempts to at least advance this area, and they show you how complicated it is. And when I went into this subject, I was a bit of a skeptic regarding modelling, and I used to quote this particular modeller who used to say all models are wrong, but some are useful, and I would add, if only to show you how difficult the real world can be. Next slide. So this is the first study. Again, the reference is there. And this comes from Takayaki Kunori, an MSc thesis, which I supervised along with others. And this included a systematic MRSA literature review looking at selective media, identification methods, susceptibility testing, and the sensitivity of sampling at different patient sites. looking through the literature, you've got to look at sensitivity, this is the false negative, specificity, that's the false positive, and the time for each stage of the testing, and we'll come back to that later. And we also use the Royal Free Hospital materials and laboratory costings, that's laboratory materials. The model that we used was actually a fairly simple one, but it does show you how complicated it can be. And it comprised an intensive care unit where all patients are screened on entry. About three quarters of the intensive care units in this country do that. We took the mean length of stay from the Royal Free and we did sensitivity analysis around that. Positive MRSA patients were isolated when they were found to be positive. From the literature, we looked at the infected cases being reduced by that amount if you do the isolation. Secondary spread was only detected by clinical, not by any other screening, and we assumed again from the literature about 30% of cases. And these were isolated and treated immediately for an average of 17 days, again from various literature. We did not consider tertiary spread. Next slide. We had a new term here, the borderline prevalence rate, which is the prevalence of MRSA patients in the number of screened patients at which the benefit of screening is equal to the costs of tests used. The literature was fairly appalling, and we had to classify the microbiological methods into the four groups that we performed. It was very difficult to compare papers. They didn't tell you, for instance, what MRSA were used, whether they were heterogeneous, resistant, and so on. So we had to actually go to using the Royal Free data and integrating it into the sensitivity, specificity, and time to result data that we got from the papers. And then we derived a cost-effectiveness ratio within each group, and then common data from this were used in the next stage. And this shows you the method a bit more clearly. So you've got swab-taking storage, then you can go straight to the direct identification methods. These were largely the PCR methods, although a lot of the newer ones, like the IDI, for example. And then on the right, you've got the different methods which you could use, so going from group C to group A, group C to group B to group A. Next slide. And then we looked at the calculation of the cost avoided, the benefit, the calculation of the cost of intervention, that's the test, and then we did a very simple benefit-cost ratio. Next slide. Now, I'll take you through this fairly slowly. You've got patients going into the intensive care unit. Let's keep it simple and go down the bottom first. You've got people who are genuinely negative, and then you've got a false positive result with them going into the isolation unit and then having unnecessary isolation. You could make this more complex, obviously, by them then becoming positive in the unit, but we didn't. Then if they're truly negative, they obviously just leave the hospital. Then on the top, you've got the colonized patients, and then you've got the delay for the result. Remember, on this intensive care unit, they're not isolated until they're known to be positive. You've got the secondary cases being created during that period. That's B1. That relates to the equations in the paper. Then you've got false negatives. That's the top, and that's X. If they are allowed on the open ward, they will continue to result in cross-infection. So you've got the secondary cases. We did not pursue the tertiary cases. That would need stochastic modeling or deterministic modeling. Then they're put into isolation, and there is literature to show that you still have spread outside the unit, so we factored that in as well. Next slide. And what we found was very cost-effective. If the proportion of MRSA colonization exceeds 2%, the money saved on MRSA control measures more than covers the cost of screening programs. And an interesting area here, if you chose just to use ciprofloxacin, Bayer-Parker, agar, because you'd be missing the quinolone-sensitive organisms, the particular modeling we showed was that it was still fine, providing 88.2% of the MRSA were quinolone-resistant. Now, no one in their right mind is just going to use that method unless you know you've got a quinolone-resistant MRSA. But that is becoming increasingly prevalent, as you know, throughout the world. And we did the sensitivity analyses in the paper. Basically, it didn't change the results. So, really, the outputs from this was that this was an easy calculation. It can be easily put into a spreadsheet. And importantly, you can modify this locally for your own costings, modeling scenarios, ways of working in the laboratory, or your own data in your hospital with SPRED. And you can look at the cost-effectiveness ratio of any combination of screening tests that you choose to use. So it's quite a sophisticated approach, but it is quite complicated. Next slide. And sure, more dynamic models are needed. We were very unsophisticated in the way we looked at laboratory costings. We're improving that now. For instance, the costs of training people, the sort of staff that you need to do these tests reproducibly over time, and how difficult these tests are, particularly the PCR ones. And we ignored, for instance, the more sophisticated costings, such as the socioeconomic burden. But we are using this in a couple of other studies right now. Together with the next paper, next slide, which Ben Cooper led, and this is the modeling of MRSA containment. And you can get this review very easily in Google. If you just put HTA and MRSA, it goes straight into it, but you have got the references at the end. There's also a BMJ paper and a PNAS paper. Next slide. And would the bugs had to wait, as it says in that cartoon. Next slide. Now, the problems we had with the systematic review was that the costing papers were all over the shop. They were different geographically. They were different over time. They ranged hugely in how comprehensive the costings were and the methods used to calculate them. So we tended to go to this modeling approach and used up-to-date costings in the real world from a London teaching hospital where our collaborators were. There are huge numbers of cost vectors that we used in the study, and you can actually see them in the appendix in that review. And there's also a very useful appendix, appendix number 5, which goes into how to assess the evidence base of a study. Next slide. Now, there's a lot of modeling in the paper. The first examples where you didn't have any isolation at all, and that indicated that costs could be very sensitive, as you might expect, to the length of stay due to the MRSA. And the costs were even more, the more transmissible the MRSA was. And obviously, the costs would also be related to how virulent it was and how vulnerable the patients were. So that has what we call face value. It's logical. Next slide. And then this is, I think, what you might describe as the approach particularly America used to use in the 80s. I remember Don Goldman now, certainly in 1990, being quite critical of it, when you just focused on the infected cases. And here you can see that it's cost-effective. In that particular model with high transmissibility and low virulence and 11 days extra stay, you can see as the isolation ward gets somewhat bigger, the cost effectiveness goes down. Next slide. And this is more the approach that people are using now, isolating infected and colonized patients. And again, here showing, you know, much greater cost effectiveness. There are some provisos which we'll come to shortly. Next slide. And this is a fascinating one. This is where you've allowed a hospital to become endemic, and then you wait 10 years, and you introduce this isolation ward, and you can show, depending on how big it is, the impact you can have. Next slide. We found that, again, face value, increasing the detection rate reduces the endemic prevalence. Critically, the intervention depends on the timing. The earlier, the better. Importantly, you must be able to scale your isolation capacity. As your challenges go up from patients coming in from the community and other hospitals, so your isolation capacity must increase. And that dynamic is very important, that last point there. If the MRSA strain can persist on patients for a long period of time, and if it can transfer between them very readily, these are key factors, as you might expect, in the long-term dynamics. So we concluded that isolation policies can be very effective over 10 years. They can prevent endemic levels from becoming established. They can reduce the endemic prevalence to lower levels. And in the modeling, they were valid over a wide range of transmissibility and virulence. And we were all quite surprised at how insensitive they were to capital costs. It can be very expensive to create these isolation wards. It is important to note that you must not have extensive periods with large numbers of unused beds. When you have that, you've got to reduce your isolation capacity and your staffing, otherwise you will lose your cost effectiveness. And another point is if you have an MRSA that is not really causing much infection, that again is challenging what we're saying now, less cost effective. Now, before we get to the next slide, I just want to make one point here. We use the word isolation capacity here and isolation ward, but really think a bit laterally here. I think of an isolation capacity as being any validated isolation system. Many hospitals cannot run an isolation ward and satisfy quality patient care. You cannot get all of the specialties represented amongst the nursing staff. So certainly most hospitals in the UK will use a mixture of side rooms, 2- and 4-bedded bays with targeted or cohorted nursing, parts of wards, whole wards, isolation wards or MRSA wards. The important thing is that when you have these systems, you've got to validate them. And the message has certainly got over in the UK, and for instance, 3/4 of intensive care units now monitor all admissions and all discharges. And that's what I mean by validating it. You're making sure that you're not getting the acquisitions and that it's working. The next slide, and this goes back to the endogenicity we mentioned about the problems of increasing length of stay. And it's important that we have basically, the bottom line here is more studies. The extra length of stay is going to contribute considerably to the costs. Patients infected with MRSA are often most ill, and they often have many factors to increase their length of stay. And increasing length of stay is going to increase the acquisition of MRSA. The longer they're in, the patients with those underlying factors contributing to longer length of stay will result in your overestimating the actual costs due to MRSA. That goes right back to the previous point I made. And really the bottom line here is that more research is needed to unravel all of these problems. The final slide is really acknowledging the immense amount of work that Ros Plowman and Nick Graves did, and also Takeaki Kanori, and also Ben Cooper, who actually converted me from being a non-believer in modeling to believing it. And I particularly liked this paper by Schmidt, which has got a very useful introduction to the essentials of economic evaluations and goes into much more detail than I've been able to do in this lecture. And then finally, you've got a couple of slides of useful references, and I'm getting rather hoarse, Paul. Thank you for your attention.
Barry, thank you very much for this presentation. It's obvious to probably all of us on this call that those areas that get funding are the departments that can show tangible value. And having tools to measure the cost of infections is very useful. Thank you very much. By the way, would you mind telling everyone what got you into the Guinness Book of World Records?
I wasn't aware I was in it.
Oh.
Is this Harmony?
Yes.
Oh, okay. No, what I said was that... you're right. I cracked a joke. You're absolutely right. So I told a fib, Paul. I told a fib. You know, you've got... It's an English joke. What I said was that I led a project called Harmony, which has got an incredibly long acronym, and it got into the book, Guinness Book of Records, as being the longest acronym of any EU grant thus awarded. You can go into the Harmony website and just see how long it is. Golly, Paul, you actually listened to what I said.
I was paying attention to you.
Wow, I'm impressed.
I was wondering what screening for MRSA is actually done in the UK. Is it just NARES, or do they do NARES and groins and wounds?
Well, in the UK, we recommend routinely nose and throat and perineum and any manipulated sites or breaks in the skin, so pressure ulcers, wounds, varicose ulcers, central venous catheters, urinary catheters, anywhere which is touched.
And this is for all admissions?
Oh, for admissions, yes, we would do nose. Some people don't do throat. Some people do nose, perineum, and any skin breaks, etc. And you can very much more cost-effectively do this. If you don't want to know exactly where they're positive, you can combine all these swabs into the same broth, and you can incubate it on a shaking incubator for about 6 hours, and then sub it, and you should get, on selective media the next morning, some sort of idea.
And are patients isolated while they're waiting?
That depends on local policy and the risk of the unit and their isolation capacity. Many people do a risk assessment. So if you have a patient who basically is fairly fit and well with minimal contact, then that would be less likely to be isolated than someone who's fairly moribund, needing loads of close contact procedures, who's got wounds, who's been in hospital, in an MRSA-positive hospital in, say, the last year.
Thank you.
What do you do about having enough single rooms for all these patients?
Yeah. Well, it's important for risk assessment to put the patients who are most likely to disperse the organism in the side rooms. So we would go for we know that people with respiratory infections and dermatological conditions and burns are more likely to shed. So they would be in the side room first, okay? Then you go, well, we go to 2 or 4 or 6 bedded bays. Now, what some people are doing, even with these, is they're getting sliding doors to be put across so that there is some sort of barrier there. Okay, and some people, for instance, in some high-risk orthopedic wards, are choosing to have any positive patients on a completely separate ward from their cold elective surgery. And then, obviously, you can grade this up to, if you've got ongoing problems, having an MRSA ward or an isolation ward.
Is there any thought of designing future hospitals with single rooms?
In the UK, we are aspiring to have, in 10 years' time, 70% of our rooms as side rooms, and already more modern hospitals are being built with more side rooms. However, some countries, a very good example of this is Sweden, have almost all their patients in 1 or 2-bedded side rooms. Yet, when they recently got a Polish strain in Stockholm and a UK strain in Gothenburg, they still had problems with the MRSA running around their wards. And we're told by the people in Sweden that when they looked at this, these particular organisms found the weak parts of the hospital where infection control was not adequate. And we've also published a paper in The Lancet just, I think it was in February, again showing on the intensive care unit that putting people into a side room where you've got poor hand hygiene compliance, and we had about 29% hand hygiene compliance, did not stop that MRSA spreading around the ward. So side rooms are not a guarantee for preventing MRSA spread. This comes back to what I was saying before. We mustn't be complacent. We must validate any intervention strategy such as isolation.
I'm just looking at how we can use this information as a business case and then also be able to say, to relate it with how many infection control practitioners you need to help prevent the infections in a facility.
Well, I mean, the literature is there. It's been there for quite some time. We are generally preaching to each other and the converted. And I think what is coming out of, for instance, a World Health Organization meeting in Venice for Central and Eastern Europe just last year, that we've got to box cleverer than we have been. And that's what I think we've been successful at doing. We have been able to work at many, many levels. For instance, politically, we've touch the pressure points of MRSA infections. And it's basically also through the media and patient advocates, so that patients basically consider it unacceptable to get an MRSA infection in a hospital. The media have gone from front page news MRSA infections, which they still do, to front page news. They used to laugh at us when we said how important hand hygiene is. We now have front page news with things like, you know, doctors not washing hands. It's become totally unacceptable. So we've changed the views of politicians and policymakers. The next problem that you have are the managers. Managers in hospitals in our country have largely ignored all of this. They are much more focused on other priorities. And the politicians used to really encourage this by, you know, driving down waiting lists and so on. We've now negotiated through, this is really the early part of the lecture, emphasizing continuous quality improvement, emphasizing how infection control is useful with the insurance agencies and with the audit commissions. And one very useful thing we've done in this country is we've negotiated with the insurance agencies different levels of infection control. So first level is more basic. Second level you go to if you do surveillance. Now, a large teaching hospital going from one level to the next saves £360,000 per year in insurance premiums. They used about £140,000 of that to employ surveillance nurses. So it's a sort of multidisciplinary, multimodal strategy that you use. Now, what was interesting in Eastern Europe was that they said that they did not want the costings from other countries. They told me they wanted the costings from their own countries. So my response to that was, then you've got to fund it. And their response was, interesting, you have to spend money to save money. So it'll be interesting to see, now they've gone back home, whether they are going to start changing their mindset and increasing investment in infection control and prevention.
Professor Cookson, thank you again very, very much. It was an interesting and useful lecture. I sure do appreciate you staying late in your office to speak to us.
My pleasure.
And thanks to everyone who has participated in this teleclass today. I look forward to joining you again very soon. Goodbye.